späte Vortrag wird sein von Harold Schuppmann, Research Fellow in St. Anthony College, Oxford. Die Thema ist die Beziehungen zwischen Bund und ISKRA bis 1903. Herr Schuppmann.
I'm afraid some of my remarks will sound like a translation of parts of Mr. Hertz's paper, and some of you may be grateful for it. I'm afraid at this late stage I can't possibly censor my...
Sir, can you speak a little bit louder?
Yes, of course. In this paper, I shall try to examine various factors that prevented the effective collaboration of the Bund and the Russian Social Democratic Labour Party and culminated in their divorce in 1903. One such factor, already widely recognised, was Lenin's intention to create a party exclusively under his own aegis and to tolerate neither factions nor groups whose aims or structure detracted in the slightest degree from his own central authority. But the factor I intend to stress in this paper concerns the attitude of the Jews in the various factions towards the question of Jewish identity. This is perhaps only another way of defining their attitude towards the question of how they should participate in the Russian revolutionary movement. My paper ends with the second Congress of the party in 1903, not only because that was where the Bund left the party, as it was then nominally constituted, but because it was at that Congress that an attempt was made to clarify the issue of Jewish participation in the Russian revolutionary movement as a whole. And in connection with this last point, I shall emphasize the importance of personal interest, which I believe lay at the root of the Bund's conflict with the party at that period. The Jewish Social Democrats, who founded the Bund in 1897, regarded the Jewish labor movement, which they were attempting to lead, as an integral part of the Russian revolutionary labor movement, in which they had already been active. They were, if not wholly Russified, at least Russian-speaking intellectuals. And right up till 1910, they conducted the Bund's congresses and conferences in Russian, although the use of Yiddish for agitation and propaganda had become almost the Bund's hallmark. It does them an injustice to gloss over the wide range of experience that had produced their generation, which, nominally cosmopolitan and internationalist, was culturally Russian. However, these early Jewish social democrats were uprooted intellectuals, culturally at home among equally uprooted but Russian intellectuals and working among Yiddish-speaking and utterly un-Russian artisans. They professed themselves to be Russian revolutionaries with the present task of organizing the Jewish section of the Russian proletariat. For years, the comings and goings of social democrats of indiscriminate ethnic origin, to and from Vilna and Minsk, and the centers of revolutionary activity inside Russia and in exile, had woven a web of contacts and collaboration which made it hard to distinguish any real organizational boundaries. Thus, the Bund's inclusion in the Russian party, which it helped to found a year after its own formation, was not even a subject for debate. Yet, at this party's founding congress, 1898, the point was specifically made that the Bund was in the party to represent the needs of the Jewish workers in Russia. In other words, in spite of all the international comings and goings, and in spite of the central relationship the Bund held in many respects to the other committees that constituted the party, already the Bund had acquired the image of the party's Jewish section. This is all by way of saying that the Bund's leaders regarded themselves as Russian social democrats. While it is true that the Bund leaders were not as exclusively intellectual as those of the party, though even this contention should not be exaggerated, It is equally plain that any worker who sought to play a part in the revolutionary movement through active and especially full-time participation in the Bund was by definition socially as well as culturally mobile and no longer just a Jewish worker. If these assertions about Jews who took part in the Bund are true, then they apply with far less reserve to those Jews who were active in the ethnically anonymous, that is, Russian, sections of the movement. After the party was founded in 1898, the already rather ramshackle system that had thus been graced with the name of a party was dealt a severe blow. Its central committee and large numbers of its small membership were all arrested later in the year. The Bund's leadership suffered similarly, though not so its local committees. As a result, the party now consisted, in name, of a few Bundist groups in Russia's western provinces and the intellectual groups in exile, which becomes the centre of interest for a while. The story of the conflict which now arose among the groups abroad is familiar enough. A struggle for control of party opinion elevated into a crusade against heresy, orthodoxy against economism, the old avant-garde of the revolution defending itself against the incursions and interferences of the new generation of revolutionaries fresh from Russia. Perhaps fundamentally Plekhanov being Plekhanov. At any rate, the Bund was not accused of economism until 1903, when the issue was already dead. At the end of the 90s, Plekhanov found other reasons to attack the Bund. After the arrest of the Bund Central Committee, help to restore the organization was sought and found abroad. A Bund Foreign Committee was set up by two experienced professionals who also acted as executives of the Union of Russian Social Democrats abroad. In their joint capacities of treasurer and secretary, they appealed for funds among the Jewish workers and students abroad, who formed the majority among Russian nationals in the working class districts and university towns of Western Europe and the United States. For a decade before this, Russian revolutionaries had been making such appeals. Now, through the same channels, the appeal was made in the name of Jewish workers in Russia, and the evidence shows that it was very successful. The Union of Russian Social Democrats abroad was the official foreign representative of the Russian Social Democratic Labour Party, and it was to this body that the Bund Foreign Committee made available its constantly improving services of fundraising and transport of illegal literature and people into Russia. As the Union became the domain of Plekhanov's enemies, and as Plekhanov's group moved into greater isolation, so the Bund came to represent to him both the enemy as such, an enemy as such, and the chief source of the Union's influence in the organizations. The existence of the Foreign Committee was of great importance for the later development of the Bund. While the committees in Russia grew and proliferated for the more or less mundane purpose of collecting the workers together and giving them a sense of solidarity, in the emigration, where intellectual issues dominated, there was the perpetual problem of making one's position clear theoretically. The Bundists abroad were constantly having to explain the existence of a social democratic organization of Jewish workers in Russia, and this involved them in discussion of the Jewish question in general and the structure of the party in particular. The fate of the national question at various Bund congresses, which I shall refer to later, indicates how difficult they must have found this topic. As Russian-speaking intellectuals abroad, they had to justify the separate existence of a Jewish Marxist organization to other Jewish intellectuals, also Russian-speaking, also striving for identification with something broader than the narrowly Jewish interests of one small section of the European movement for social progress. At this point, I might add that it may seem ironic that these Bundist intellectuals, so Russian in outlook, indeed regarded as Russifiers by Pole and Zionist alike, should finally emerge in the eyes of their Russian comrades as Jewish separatists and nationalists. The Bund's influence in the Union grew, and so did Plekhanov's hostility for that very reason. Yet little or nothing of this antagonism was felt in Russia. Lenin and Martov and their Iskra agencies emerged and gradually ramified, and even though their alliance with Plekhanov caused trouble with the Bund's Foreign Committee, in Russia the Bund actually collaborated in the establishment of contact points for Iskra's transport, though not for long. In the conflict which arose in 1903, much was made of the Bund's Fourth Congress of 1901 as the origin of the evils that now beset the Bund. At that Congress, it was said, the Bund turned finally from its internationalist path and gave in to nationalist strivings, which had been latent in its younger, less Russified second generation. From that point, the Bund was said to have pursued a policy of aggressive expansion, trespassing onto the territory of harmoniously integrated Russian and Jewish workers' organizations, dividing them, Jew from Russian, Jew from Let, and setting up for its own greater glory Bundist committees, narrowly concerned with the exclusive tribal interests of Jewish artisans. This complaint, which was voiced 2 years after the criminal policy was alleged to have begun, became the basis of an anti-Bund campaign conducted by Iskra. The fact is that the Bund decided in 1901 to set up committees in the south of Russia if the need arose. Lenin's objection was that it was the Bund and not Iskra which decided whether a need existed. The collision of the two organizations, the Bund, already strong and well-established, and Iskra, dominated by a single-minded aspiration to complete leadership, was not only foreseeable, it was planned. Calculated attempts were made to detach the support the Bund gave the Union abroad, to which the Plekhanov-Iskra coalition was implacably opposed. Largely because the Bund was already so independent, these attempts failed, as did attempts to divide the Bund in Russia from its representatives abroad, its intellectual leadership, and its source of funds and literature. However, the national question did become an issue which began to loom in the life of the Bund. Already in 1899, at the Third Congress, it was introduced from abroad and dismissed from the agenda as inappropriate to an internationalist gathering. In 1901, again under influence from abroad, it came up at the Fourth Congress. By this time, it had become a main debating topic among Jewish students in exile, who needed to rebut Zionist arguments with something more substantial than vague hopes of international brotherhood or the Marxist formula of self-determination. For Jews, it was precisely a question of determining the self. The Fourth Congress debated the question fully and came to the conclusion that the Jews were indeed a nation which should gain full cultural autonomy in a future democratic Russia. But the dominant feeling of the Congress was that the Bund should not adopt a national platform, although it should fight against all forms of oppression and discrimination. National agitation, it was feared, would arouse national prejudice and dim class consciousness. Lieber, who was influenced by the émigrés, wanted full-blooded agitation for national autonomy. Portnoy and Rosenthal, both immersed in the underground of Russia, wanted to restrict agitation to opposition of discrimination and oppression, that is, traditional social democratic work. Rosenthal went further and roundly rejected the whole issue as an artificial import from abroad, having nothing in common with the Jewish masses, who had recently been weaned from traditional suspicion towards Russians by the Bund's internationalist propaganda. As a postscript to this debate, I would mention that in 1903, when everyone was acutely aware that a collision with Iskra was imminent, when the Fifth Congress of the Bund again debated the national question, it was so completely divided, in half in fact, that no resolution was adopted. And the question was erased from the agenda, as published, and the debates were not published until the 1920s, and then not in full. Meanwhile, Iskra's ascendancy continued abroad and in Russia, and the scandals and machinations that now took place were mainly connected with the convening of the Second Party Congress. Late in 1902, to bypass all the legalistic and tiresome formalities involved in calling a genuinely representative Congress, Lenin simply created his own organizing committee, through which alone committees could gain access to the Congress, but recognition of which was made synonymous with recognition of Iskra. Thus, Iskra became the party, and the party was to become Iskra. In the Bund, Lenin saw a major obstacle. It was a large and powerful organization, aspiring, but for the opposition of a few of its utopian idealists, to the status of a national party. Lenin provoked a series of fierce polemics with the Foreign Committee of the Bund, from which the committees in Russia remained aloof. Even some of Lenin's advanced guard Iskraists in Russia were puzzled and disturbed by their leader's aggressiveness. By the time of the Congress, however, Lenin had succeeded in creating the image of the Bund as a separatist, splitting agency, a chauvinistic conspiracy aimed at the isolation of all the Jewish workers of Russia within its own little ghetto. This kind of propaganda could not be effective among the self-assured, non-professional, revolutionary Jewish students abroad. Most of them would remain attached to their Jewish identity, whether they supported Zionism, the Bund, the Russian Social Democrats, or the Socialist Revolutionaries. And in any case, his propaganda was not aimed at them. It was aimed at, and was most effective, among Iskra's own Jewish members. And it was they who crowned his campaign against the Bund with success. According to Lenin's own analysis, just half the votes at the Congress were held by Jews. We have no direct indication whether he regarded this fact as a danger or a safeguard. The proceedings of the Congress, however, give a clear enough answer. Lenin had placed the Bund first on his own private agenda well before the Congress began. It was the first point of indoctrination of Iskra's delegates. At the Congress itself, every effort was made to maintain resistance to Bundist overtures among Lenin's Jewish supporters. And even though the Bund succeeded in opening up some chinks in Iskra's armor, on questions affecting nationality, language, and regional organization, when it came to the question of the Bund's own existence as an organization concerned with protecting the interests of the Jewish workers, not one single vote was cast with those of the Bund's own delegates. 2 weeks of lobbying, with all their experience, their personal contacts and friendships among the delegates of highest standing, and above all their shared Jewishness with half the delegates, and yet the Bund failed to secure the support of a single Iskraist on the question of its survival in the party. It is patently futile to attribute this solidarity to loyalty to Lenin and Martov, or to sheer cretinism. Within hours, the same comrades would be showing extreme independence and splitting the party in half. The explanation must therefore lie in their attitude to the Bund. The Bund issue, which Lenin raised for his own purposes, represented for Jewish social democrats outside the Bund a formalization of the much broader and vaguer question of Jewish identity as such, and one which they had reacted to up to that time, perhaps unconsciously. The Bund conflict now, in the open, and in the formal setting of a party congress, where questions were finally answered with a short yes or no, and the vote was duly written down in the protocols, plainly offered an opportunity to state unequivocally one's repudiation of one's past inferiority and one's membership of the International Brotherhood. To perform, that is, a necessary act of identification. An obvious objection to my interpretation is that the Mensheviks, who at that time, the time I'm discussing, were the worst enemies of the Bund, who indeed led the attacks, and declined to support the Bund, even after the Bund had guaranteed their ascendancy over Lenin, became, in a short time, close allies of the Bund. My explanation is that these Jewish Mensheviks were, in fact, liberated from their conflict over identity by their decisive act of affirmation. And the same can be said of the Jewish Bolsheviks and even of the Bundists themselves. Having thus unburdened themselves of their ambivalent attitude to their Jewishness, one way or the other, the problem could thus cease to have the kind of powerful effect on their behavior which the Second Congress witnessed. At the same time, the Bund ceased to represent a reproach. It was this fear that Lenin had mobilized to defeat the Bund, and in so doing, he inadvertently demonstrated to the Jewish Iskraists that the Bund's much advertised omnipotence was mythical.
Thank you, Dr. Schuchman.